I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest tonight is Neil Kumar. Neil, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. And my co-host today is Robert Wallace, who works for Countercurrents. Robert, welcome to the stream.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be here, as always.
Neil is our guy in Arkansas. He's running for the House of Representatives, the national U.S. House of Representatives in the state of Arkansas in the 3rd District in the Ozarks. And he's running as an open white advocate. He is talking about things like the Great Replacement, talking about dismantling the Civil Rights Act, talking about doing away with things like affirmative action. And he's very articulate about this. He also wants to defend Southern heritage. And I think it's great to have him on, have him out there. We ran an extensive story on him. I hope somebody will link it in the chat, a piece by Giles Corey called Our Man in Arkansas, which outlines a lot of Neil's platform and his history. And it would be useful if you want to consult that, folks. If you would like to ask the candidate some questions, then I urge you to go to Entropy. And I'm going to put that on the screen now. There are two ways that you can send donations to Countercurrents with a credit card. One is through Cash App, and the other is through Entropy. And if you use Entropy, you can leave a question or a comment that we will read in the course of tonight's stream. We will answer as many of your questions as possible, all of them if we can, and we'll do it very thoroughly. So if you have a question for the panel or for Neil in particular, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. So Neil, I just want to ask you, how did you get in this position? How did you decide to run as a Republican, but on an openly pro-white platform in the state of Arkansas? And can you tell us a bit about the reception you've gotten?
Yeah, so I'm running as a Republican out of necessity because, you know, like it or not, we have a two-party system, and independent and third-party candidates just don't really stand a chance. So that's primarily the reason for the GOP alignment, even though obviously I despise the GOP and they despise me. Why am I running as an open white advocate is because now is the time. White genocide is real and it's happening. There's a cultural genocide going on, monuments, history books, anything which celebrates the white heroes and pioneers who built this nation is being burned to the ground. We have no borders. The regime allied with a constellation of NGOs and quote unquote charities with infinite funding is engaged in ethnic cleansing and erasing whites from the nation which they single-handedly built. We've got midnight flights carrying refugees and other invaders across our nation, resettling them in areas without the infrastructure to support them, i.e. rural white communities. The very image of a white nation is being eradicated. You turn on the TV or go to a movie theater, right? The opioid plague is a deliberate attack on greater Appalachia, on white America, by big pharma and corrupt regulatory agencies. We've lost almost a million Americans, almost all white, to this plague over the last two decades, which is more than the number of Americans killed in all of our wars all put together. I lost one of my best friends to an overdose, and Arkansas as a whole suffered the third largest increase in the white mortality rate in the entire country. Fentanyl coming across our wide open border is the number one cause of death for Americans 18 to 45, right? This isn't suicide, it's murder. And you can say anything you want about whites now. The rhetoric coming from the regime, from the media, from academia is literally genocidal. They're openly calling for the extinction of the white race, for annihilation. They call whiteness a, you know, parasitic condition for which there is yet no cure. Now, what is that but a call for mass murder? Leftists openly talk in gruesome detail about everything they want to do to whites. So, you know, think the picture is not good in this country for the majority population. And as of yet, there is nobody representing whites. They are a completely stateless people without any representation whatsoever. And so, you know, I see this this void, and I'm here to fill it and hopefully show other candidates that it's okay to run on these issues, to talk about what everyone knows is happening already in their minds, but it's just too cowed to talk about it.
I think that's well said. I think it's very, very important. And of course, the first thing that a lot of people are going to say, I'm sure it's going to pop up in the chat and so forth, is, but wait a second, Neil Kumar isn't even entirely white. Your father is from South Asia. He's from India. Your mother is a white American woman, old stock American woman. And so they think this can't be the case. Well, what's going on here? How is this possible? Now, before you go on, I just want to say, as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing wrong with the fact that, say, Eric Zemmour, who's an Algerian Jew or of Algerian Jewish descent in France, is running for the president of France, and he's talking about the Great Replacement openly, and he wants to defend the French people. I'm not going to criticize him because of his background for saying this. It's not shameful for him to do this. The real shame is the fact that it takes an Algerian Jew to stand up for whites explicitly, for the white French people. And there aren't hordes of white French politicians who are doing the same thing. It's not shameful for him to be saying what he's saying. It's shameful that there aren't thousands of other quote-unquote better qualified people doing it. And the same for Neil. I think it's quite remarkable that here's a guy of mixed heritage who sees the Great Replacement as a problem and wants to stand up and fight against it. And I don't think it's a valid criticism of him so much as it's a massive indictment of all the white politicians who don't do that, who sort of are sitting around and talking about things like welfare reform and at best dog whistling to white concerns. So Neil, how do you square the fact that you've got a mixed heritage with the fact that you're standing up against the Great Replacement and for the white majority in Arkansas and America as a whole?
Yeah, well, just to go to your last point, Jared Taylor's tremendous speech at this year's Amrin conference, it posed the same issue. You know, white men have fought and died for all kinds of causes, every cause under the sun, and yet they're nowhere to be found in the greatest struggle that's ever faced, white America, right? So why is that? But anyway, despite my last name, I am descended from pre-revolutionary stock. My maternal line is Scots-Irish, and we've called this nation home since the 1600s in South Carolina. So that's 400 years of Southern ancestry that I have. And I grew up a Southerner. I have no, you know, I'm not a Hindu. I'm a Christian. I don't speak Hindi. I've visited India twice, but I have no, you know, cultural attachment or loyalty whatsoever to India. I mean, this is my country. I'm a proud member of the Sons of the American Revolution, and I'm a life member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. I've got at least 8 ancestors that fought for the Confederacy, and I've got at least 1 ancestor that served in the Revolutionary War. And my father is Indian. He came to America in 1984, and he became a citizen in 2001. Now, obviously, my dad wouldn't have been able to come here without the 1965 Hart-Celler Immigration Act. That has no impact whatsoever on me knowing that that act was one of the worst attacks our nation ever suffered. I want to overturn it completely. We have to go back to something like the National Origins Formula. And in fact, you know, I specifically have called for accepting Europeans, Australians, and Canadians that are fleeing totalitarian medical tyranny, as well as Afrikaners that are facing dispossession and genocide in South Africa. And you'll see on my platform, the number one issue that I say is we have to stop the Great Replacement. I make no distinction between legal and illegal immigration because they're both the same, an attack on our national sovereignty and an attack on white America. So what I'm calling for is a 20-year moratorium on all immigration, deporting every illegal, building the wall, and then in the meantime, ending birthright citizenship, denying public services to illegals, and taxing remittances at up to 100%.
Neil, I think that I agree with everything that you've said so far. And I'll say this, that I will never engage in any personal attack on any public figure who is pro-white. Okay. That's how I feel in my heart. I appreciate everyone, the sacrifices they've made and the inconvenience of being a white advocate. And it's very deleterious to the interests of my position at Countercurrents at the Policy Institute. I need to be a unifier and a source of cooperation. So that applies to you as well, of course, my friend. And you have every right to claim your status as member to the historic American nation, because I know that you have 400 years. It's an ancient American heritage. And so I'm coming out, to publicly endorse you and support you and defend you. So that's my commentary on that.
I support various wildlife preservation projects. I want to save tigers, for instance. And if somebody popped up and said to me, "But you're not a tiger, why do you care about tigers?" I would have a pretty ready answer for that. Well, they're beautiful creatures. They're unique. They're being killed off for stupid, ignoble reasons. It's a great crime to destroy the tigers. You don't have to be a tiger to be a tiger advocate. You don't have to be. You don't have to be entirely white to be a white advocate either. And I think that that's simply a fact. What we stand for as white identitarians is ultimately our genetic identity. We want to preserve that. But there are ideas connected with our struggle that can be embraced by people who don't share that same genetic identity. Just as I can be an advocate for tigers and other forms of wildlife, it's possible for people who are entirely non-white to still look at what's happening to white people in the United States and say that this is a historic crime. It needs to stop. It's a historic crime in France, and basically every white country, every white majority country is facing some form of demographic decline. Some of them have open borders and race replacement immigration going on. And there are a lot of people that I've encountered over the years from the Far East, from South Asia, from the Middle East, people who are not white, who are saying, why don't white people stand up for themselves and stop this? A few years ago at an American Renaissance conference, Jared actually read a lot of comments that he had received over the years and filed away from non-whites around the world who read American Renaissance and sympathize with the white cause. And I think that that's entirely possible. It's entirely reasonable. And to spurn such support is just dumb, because to win, we need more people on our side and fewer people fighting against us. And if we want to define the struggle entirely in terms of it's just us versus the whole world, well, we're going to make it harder if we don't accept that there can be allies and sympathizers, even of other races on other continents. So that's my thinking on this. There are, even if there are people who are not marriage candidates for, strict white identitarians, they can still share our views and sympathize with our cause and be friendly, be allies, be useful people. And again, when you see somebody like Eric Zemmour or Neil Kumar standing up for the historic white nation of France or the historic white nation of the United States, it's no shame that they're not entirely white. The shame is the fact that we have thousands and thousands of other politicians out there who aren't standing up for white people. So Neil, how did you come to this position? How did you start thinking that America is being destroyed by race replacement?
Well, you know, I went to undergraduate college at the University of Chicago, and went. So I grew up in Bentonville, Arkansas, which is at the time that I was growing up, and it still is. I mean, it's like 90% white, and so you know, when you live in almost all white communities, you can entertain these comfortable delusions about the world, and you believe the education system propaganda. And then I went to the University of Chicago, which is in Hyde Park on the South Side. And I mean, it's a very brutal, rude awakening to go to a majority black area and see the reality of racial differences. So, you know, you see black crime, you see that race differences are not about skin color. They're much deeper than that, much more fundamental, much more primal. And so I questioned pretty quickly in, you know, if I've been lied to about something as massive as the reality of race, then what else have I been lied to about? And this kind of dovetailed with 2016, Donald Trump's campaign, 2015 and 16. And I saw how, you know, someone that I consider to be non-ideological, civic nationalist, pragmatist. I mean, Donald Trump is very mild. He's not extreme at all. And I saw the like every center of institutional power on earth come down on this man for daring to talk in a relatively oblique way about the concerns of whites, right? He wasn't even very explicit about whites. He used euphemisms like America, right? But we all know what he's talking about, and so did the leftist establishment. And so seeing the entire global system come down on this man, it just opened my eyes, and I'm thinking, you know, wow, he's really onto something. Like I said, one of my best friends died of a drug overdose, and several others from my high school class. And I see what it was doing to Arkansas. So I started doing research into Big Pharma and into the Sackler family. And so you got all this going on, and I just started to re-educate myself. You know, like I read Jared Taylor's White Identity, books like that. And I started reading American Renaissance, Countercurrents, and I saw the light. And, you know, I mean, there's a reason why every racial group is not only allowed, but encouraged to have a, ethnocentric worldview, right? In rigid lockstep, does this benefit my race? But whites are not allowed to have that. White identity is uniquely excoriated, demonized. And so, I saw the opposition to whites in their own country, and it opened my eyes.
That's great. So I was going to ask you about some websites and authors who influenced you, who helped red pill you. You mentioned Jared Taylor, you mentioned American Renaissance. Can you name some other people that were important, people that you would recommend that other people read?
Well, what I recommend to people that don't know anything at all is White Identity. I think it's a very accessible book, and that's the best entryway. That's what Jared Taylor's project is that it's a clean, respectable, intellectual, dispassionate source of information, and so that's the gateway for the wider universe. So that's typically the book that I recommend to people.
That's great. So let's talk about the declaration that you're running for Congress. How did that go down with the Republican Party? Did they for instance, sort of, I don't know, did they look favorably upon you when you first showed up, this guy with a dark complexion and an exotic surname? They're thinking, oh my goodness, you know, another Candace Owens, perhaps. Here's somebody, Nikki Haley, another Nikki Haley, who can get up there and allow us to say the same old stupid Republican shit, but make it seem diverse. And so we can tick these intersectional boxes off and then go back to basically tax cuts for billionaires, pandering to Black people, giving away huge amounts of money to our greatest ally and so forth. Was there any kind of courtship period at the beginning before they started realizing that maybe you were off the reservation, so to speak?
I'm trying to restrain my laughter. That's very accurately stated with regard to Candace Owens and Nimrata Randhawa, or as she calls herself, Nikki Haley. No, not at all. I mean, like I said, at the top of my platform is Stop the Great Replacement. So I never beat around the bush about who I am and the issues that I care about. So from day one of my campaign, the Republican Party of Arkansas has really done everything that it can to suppress me. I was proudly disavowed by them as a racist, sexist bigot, and I'm only the third candidate in U.S. history to be denounced by a state GOP during a contested primary. They're technically not allowed to do that, but hey, what the hell, they did it anyway, and it's the greatest endorsement that I could have gotten.
So you are in the august company of David Duke then?
Yes.
He was the first guy, right? He was the first guy that they decided to chuck all the rules and principles, because this was important. They actually urged people to vote for an open crook because it was important. It was vote for the crook. It's important.
Anything to prevent whites from having representation.
Yeah, the last thing I have to say on this, and it has been said, and Greg, I agreed with every single thing that you had said on this before. We have a very firm and clear goal, and that is the goal that we outlined in our America is Ready for White Identity Politics article. That is to normalize and mainstream pro-white politics to the patriotic American public. So the criteria here is, Neil Kumar, Michelle Malkin, are they effective towards getting us closer to that goal or not? And my firm opinion on this is that Neil is effective. And so we need to be as ruthlessly calculating and pragmatic as our enemies are in order to beat them. So that's the last thing I have to say on this.
Well, I agree. I think we need to be pragmatic and calculating. There's good pragmatism and bad pragmatism. Usually in politics, what people say is pragmatic is to chuck your principles overboard and do all kinds of stupid pandering. Whereas in this case, I don't think we have to chuck our principles overboard, because what's great about Neil's candidacy is that he's talking about our principles. He's standing up for our principles. And that changes the political debate. That shifts, as they say, the Overton window. And that is going to provide encouragement to other candidates as well.
And doing so articulately as well, Greg. And yes, we need to be idealistic at the same time. I describe myself as a racial idealist, Sam Dixon, borrowing Sam Dixon's term, the first podcast I did. But yes, I agree with everything that you just said. Greg.
Like you were just saying, I think one of the major turning points that led the GOP to the awful place that it is, to this anti-white position, is the neocon strategies of people like Karl Rove with this compassionate conservatism, big tent nonsense. The purpose of the big tent is not to sacrifice everything that you value in order to get more people in the door. The purpose of a big tent should be to accurately eloquently articulate your ideas so that more people come in the door to come to your way of thinking, right? Not to sacrifice your way of thinking. And then going back to this Republican disavowal, there's a National File article that just came out on this. There's a state representative candidate here. His name is Greg Payne. He's a local attorney, and he's got ties to Explore Talent, which is an apparent Israeli influence operation, which launched the careers of a number of GOP pundits and personalities, including Representative Lauren Boebert. So this Greg Payne character, he's an attorney for local pedophiles, and he actually managed to infiltrate the Arkansas GOP so successfully that I'm told he's the one that was responsible for getting the chairman of the party to disavow me. And I know for a fact that from the very beginning of my campaign, he's been running a smear campaign against me. So clearly he's a paid operative, and the Israel link is certainly suggestive. And speaking of Israel, according to the ADL, I'm an extremist. So I got the coveted ADL endorsement as one of the most dangerous candidates in America, which I consider an insult because I'm actually the most dangerous. In fact, the only real threat to the anti-white America last cabal.
Yeah, that's great. So what are some other endorsements that you've gotten from our enemies, so to speak? You've been disavowed by the Republicans, check. The ADL has denounced you as an extremist. Has the SPLC weighed in on your candidacy yet?
Not yet, but fingers crossed. I've been banned from two payment processors, Anadot and WinRed, which are the two biggest GOP fundraising platforms. My barbershop of several years actually banned me, said I'm no longer welcome as a customer there. They don't, apparently cutting my hair is an endorsement of my politics. And then I was banned from Facebook pretty early on, and I managed to get back on Facebook, but I'm very heavily censored, and I'm completely banned from Twitter for the crime of saying that Derek Chauvin did nothing wrong.
Absolutely. That's great. I thought the Chauvin verdict was absolutely a verdict on America, a negative verdict on America. You know, nice white people don't like to face the fact that the knee of order needs to be firmly planted on the neck of chaos at all times, or civilization will fall apart. And we got a wonderful lesson in exactly how fragile civilization is in the aftermath of the George Floyd brouhaha. All this police abolition, the intimidation of police, crime has gone absolutely mad in the United States. Yes, because we've taken the knee of order off the neck of chaos. And the problem for, you know, the problem can be put this way. There's this great line in Yeats's poem, The Second Coming. He says, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. And the worst people in America are full of passionate intensity. They're the left. They're crazed people who, if given their way, will wreck and destroy civilization. And the best, in quotes, are the putative guardians of law and order, the Republicans, conservative types, establishmentarian types. What did they do while America was burning? They basically stood around shuffling their feet, their hands in their pockets, hoping that it would all go away before they had to do anything courageous. And it's despicable. It's depressing. Donald Trump was totally cowed in the face of the mob, basically. And it was he was getting all these people whispering in his ear, "Oh, you can't shoot down rioters," even though it would have saved a lot of lives and a lot of livelihoods if he'd just sent the National Guard in on the second day of riots in Minneapolis and shut it all down. We would have been spared months of bloodshed and chaos, but he was too cowardly. He was listening to these people saying, "Oh no, you've got to court the black vote." So I guess my question here, if there is a question, is this, how do we get this passionate intensity on the right. What we stand for is correct and good. And yet the people who are sort of putatively our champions are really very cowardly and milquetoast types. And do we give some of these people some courage? Do we work on their gut? Can we salvage some of these people? Or do we just have to push these people aside and replace them?
I think the entire Republican Party needs to be burned down and replaced, rebuilt from the ground up. These people are largely not salvageable. You mentioned President Trump. I mean, he cowered in the nuclear bunker while feral thugs toppled a statue outside the White House, right? I mean, what kind of leadership is that? You saw the FBI and the police all over the country kneeling in solidarity with these violent thugs. I don't know. So look at the squad on the left, right? AOC and Omar and Tlaib. These, Ayanna Pressley, look at how they've been able to change the discourse on the left with such a small number, right? So the way that I see it, if you elect, I mean, just one person like me, that's the beginning of a sea change within the GOP, because people see, wow, this rhetoric actually works. And what my job would be is just to point the finger, shine a light, expose these people for who they are. And, you know, they have to let me talk on the floor. So just imagine me going onto the floor of Congress and talking about white genocide. I mean, what would that do? It would be front page news all over the world, right? And so I don't think that it really is going to take that much to destroy the current iteration of the GOP. It just takes one or two people. And then what I try to counsel people as well, a large part of the reason why the GOP leadership is so milquetoast is that, you know, at the local level, people just aren't involved in their communities. Apathy is how we got here. So you go to these county GOP meetings and very few people show up. I mean, maybe 15, 20, 30 people. So, you know, why don't you show up and bring 15 or 20 pro-white patriots? By sheer numbers alone, you elect yourself into leadership, and then you control a county GOP. And then you do it with enough counties in your state, and you control a state GOP, and so forth, until you get to the RNC. So I don't think that the task is too difficult. There's just a lack of willpower. So, you know, how do you get that willpower is electing candidates like me, just to show that it's possible. Because even though everyone is called a racist now, for whatever reason, that word still has some kind of staying power. It's like a magical word. And so, you know, I said on Gab recently, if you're afraid of being called a racist, then you don't deserve your country. And so people have to get over this spinelessness.
That's well said.
So I think I wonder what Neil's opinion is on this, Greg. We've been talking about this over the past couple of weeks. You know, we need to build a political infrastructure the way that other interest groups, really every other effective interest group has. And that will be a lobby. That will be a monster pack where we can run candidates like Neil. And that will be a vehicle where we can muscle and pressure, because I don't think it's a wise strategy to abandon the Republican Party, because it's like you said, Greg, the voters are on our side. The elites are not. But, you know, look at what AIPAC has done. You know, they control the Republican Party. Look at what the NRA has done. They can apply a lot of influence and muscle on the Republican Party. So I think the way to go would be to build a mass grassroots membership organization modeled like the NRA, and be able to mobilize that grassroots energy to impose our will on the Republican Party. What do you think about that, Neil and Greg? I'd love to hear your feedback on this as well.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, you mentioned the example of AIPAC, and they grade politicians on how loyal they are to a foreign country. And so, I mean, imagine an organization which was able to leverage pressure on politicians and grade legislation based on how good it is for white America, right? So, you know, every racial group evaluates a piece of legislation or a policy proposal with one question and one question only. Does this benefit blacks? Does this benefit Mexicans?
Yes.
And if the answer is no, then they don't do it. So we need to be asking the same thing, but for whites.
And every other political interest group has an infrastructure like this. And that's what we need to have. We must have that.
There's an essay that I wrote a couple years ago now. It's called The Uppity White Folks Manifesto. It's the last chapter in my book, White Identity Politics. And in there, I talk about Ashley Jardina. She has this book, White Identity Politics, that came out in 2019. And this is before the Brandon administration, right? It's before the stolen election. It's before critical race theory is running amok and George Floyd is now a saint and BLM is burning the country down and all these other polarizing things that have happened since then. The book came out in 2019. It's based on studies that are earlier. And these studies indicate a number of remarkable facts. They indicate that white Americans, a significant percentage of white Americans, have a positive racial identity. It's far lower than what you would have with blacks and Hispanics, but it's a significant number. A significant percentage of white Americans believe that whites are being discriminated against, that the regime is anti-white. They believe that the white guilt narrative, the systematic racism narrative, is false. They reject that. And they also believe that whites should collectivize to preserve their interests. This is a significant percentage of the white population in America. They're overwhelmingly people who were voting for Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020. And since 2020, these people have been enormously radicalized. And so there are a lot more of these people now. I would love to see the same polls done with the same questions that Jardina was analyzing in this 2019 book today. Because I think it's going to indicate that there's a vast number of people who are receptive to this message, that basically white identity politics of some form. Now, they might not be advocates for a white ethno state, but they want white people to take their side, their own side, in a fight, and they realize that there's an ethnic conflict in politics today. That's a huge number of people, and the Republican Party mainstream is absolutely opposed to representing these people. So that is an enormous opportunity for politicians like Neil Kumar to step forward and represent that. And if he can be somewhat successful in this campaign, that could be the thing that that's necessary to get other people to step forward, because it is the way forward for rightist populist politics in America, is to go explicit white identitarian. The Republican establishment is going to try and just coast into power on backlash politics, run on the platform, let's go Brandon, dog whistle maybe a little bit. They don't even have to do that. And it's a real threat that these people are just going to get a huge wave of support, a massive endorsement, and then they will go back to Republicanism as usual. That's a terrible threat. But there is an indication that a lot of people are ready for the kind of things that Neil is saying. So have you had people approach you, Neil, and say, Neil, it's just not smart to be so explicit about this. Why don't you just dog whistle? Why don't you talk about, how great it is to be the son of an immigrant, and then attack welfare or something like that.
How bad critical race theory is for black people.
Yeah, exactly. It's especially bad for black people. Yeah.
Yeah. Matt Gaetz actually made a post on his social media yesterday criticizing Biden vowing to select a black woman as the next Supreme Court justice by saying that it's insulting to blacks. I mean, these people need to get with the program. They're living in an alternate reality. But anyway, yeah, this race would have been a lot easier for me if I had just done the, you know, let's go Brandon with the brown face and talk about, you know, the American dream being the son of an immigrant, right? But that's not me. I'm running on who I am. And because I firmly believe, as Robert's recent article put it, America is ready for white identity politics. You saw this, you know, more than anything else with the school boards and the critical race theory. You're seeing really for the first time since George Wallace led the fight against forced busing, you're seeing parents advocating for themselves and for their children as whites. Look at the Virginia gubernatorial election. Yeah, Glenn Youngkin is a textbook cuck. He sucks. But that race was a vindication, a resounding vindication of white identity politics. There's a real sea change underway. The enemy, unable to control its visceral, all-consuming genocidal fervor towards eliminating whites, is boiling the proverbial frog too fast. You're seeing Fox News capitalizing white and using the term anti-white. Revolver, the biggest MAGA site, put Jared Taylor's tremendous piece on the McMichael verdict at the top of its homepage. That's massive. Peter Brimlow's speech at the Ameren conference made the point that there's no ceiling for the white vote in the GOP, and the floor for the Democrats is zero. So unless the GOP stops being ashamed of its almost entirely white base and starts fighting tooth and nail against their replacement, it is headed for the ash heap, and deservedly so. Now, you mentioned the stolen election. And whites are, with good reason, losing faith in the political process. And I don't blame anyone for thinking that there are no political solutions. That's not a black pill. It's just a statement of fact. It's not too late yet. But unless the GOP embraces white identity politics, and now it and the political process itself, as we know it, is over. The future is clear. It's now or never. This is the decisive decade. Whites must embrace white identity politics or perish, because the other non-white, anti-white identity politics is not going to go away anytime soon. It's only going to accelerate from here.
So are there some other candidates who are making overtures in the right direction? I know Blake Masters, who's running for Senate in the state of Arizona, has openly talked about how critical race theory is anti-white. He said it. He just said it's anti-white. I thought that was a positive thing. I'm sure he had consultant types saying, oh, no, you can't say that. Just talk about how bad it is for black people, but don't say it's anti-white, even though it's obviously anti-white. Are there other candidates that you think have some promising positions? Do you see some shift in a direction of a more nationalist, more populist, and most importantly, more white identitarian front in the GOP?
Well, I'll first state that there's nobody running for any office in America that talks like me about these issues. There are a few that are making those overtures in the right direction. You mentioned Blake Masters. Don Huffines is running for governor of Texas. And he called critical race theory anti-white. And then Paul Gosar has also used the term anti-white. He appeared at, I'm forgetting the big one. President Trump said, I don't know if he said anti-white, but he talked about discrimination against white people, which is the same thing. And Paul Gosar appeared at that same rally. And then later that day, he put out a post on Gab and used the word anti-white. And like I mentioned, Fox News and Revolver, that's pretty big. So you are seeing a shift. It's happening. I think it's only going to get better, but like you all are already mentioned, there's a risk that this newfound bravery is only because the GOP is in the minority right now. And there is a big risk that if it retakes the majority, that it'll just go back to business as usual, because we know who the GOP's donors are and we know what their priorities are, and it has nothing to do with white America.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yes, and I'll say, and I know Greg agrees with me here, is that I don't think it's wise to alienate people like that, like Gosar and Master, because of this. They repurpose our talking points. Exactly. So what does that tell you? It tells you that they're most probably engaged with our media outlets. And so they're sort of fellow travelers, and we have reason to believe that because, again, they're repurposing our rhetoric. And they have very powerful and influential friends.
Tucker Carlson as well. He regularly repurposes dissident right.
They have powerful and influential friends, and we want to be able to court the support of those people down the line. Now, people like Yoram Hazony, they need to be demoralized and attacked. And, of course, the typical conservatives, because, of course, everybody will support us in that as well.
You know, Hazony was so fascinating when his National Conservatism Conference rolled out the first time. It was before COVID, and I registered for it, and he wrote to me and said that I couldn't come. He personally sent me a letter saying, no, you can't register for my conference. And I just thought it was hilarious because it was like he couldn't help himself. It's in my nature. He just reverted to the gatekeeping type just like that. It's like, oh, no, we're going to draw the line here against all you wasists and keep you out. He's really just living down to the worst stereotypes that unfortunately his tribe live by. It's very interesting, the Edmund Burke Institute, who, you know, what could be more goyish and conservative than Edmund Burke? The Edmund Burke Institute, which runs his National Conservatism Conferences, has the exact same staff as the Theodore Herzl Institute in Jerusalem, basically. It's literally a Zionist op. Herzl is the father of Zionism. And so the Herzl Institute has this operation called the Burke Institute, which runs these national conservatism conferences. And they immediately went into gatekeeping mode when people like Jared Taylor and me tried to just show up. We just wanted to see what they were selling, right? But they want to keep us out. So, you know, the false opposition is real. The gatekeepers are real. But the truth is that they have access to polls and data that we don't have access to yet. Israel has, you know, some great spying apparatus. Not only do they have friends in all the media, they have people snooping and spying on people's communications. There's a great story that just came out in the New York Times about this. They have great data. If anybody in this world has data about the rise of white identity politics, the threat of white identity politics, it's going to be people in Israel. And isn't it interesting how there's this Israeli operation, this Zionist operation, trying to get out ahead of nationalism and populism and channel it away from white identitarianism. I think that's fascinating. They are doing it because they're scared, and they're scared because they see what's happening. Now, I would like to know what they know. And that's one of the things that we need. And this is one of the reasons why I'm in the process of building a policy institute, because we want to have trained social scientists and the money to conduct polls and studies and probe the public mind and get a good sense of where people are at on nationalism and populism and anti-globalization and white identity politics. It would be great to have an institution that can provide fine-grained, detailed data to candidates like Neil Kumar and say, we rate your chances very high in your district. We think that, you know, up to 40% of people in your district would endorse, you know, 2 out of 3 white identitarian positions, things like that. Someday we will be in a position to do that. And someday will be in a position to take that kind of data to every Republican and say,
yes,
this is the public mind. You can get with it. You can get out ahead of it. You can try and cater to this, or you're going to be shoved aside by people who will. We need to know that. And I think that we can know that. There's interesting data that's already coming out that's showing this transformation in consciousness. If we had access to this, if we could have much more fine-grained and detailed analyses of the public mind, we could really weaponize that politically and use that. Because right now, we're a specter, basically, the specter of white nationalism. The left loves to talk about white nationalists and racists and white supremacists. We're just a stalking horse to scare people, you know, scare old ladies into writing checks to the SPLC. But what if we became something more than just a specter? What if we became a much more concrete threat? There are 45 million of us, 45,222,011 of us. And we're in these districts, and you have to tread very carefully here and here and here and here and here. And we could point that out. That would be beautiful. And the day will come when we can start doing that. And that kind of information is extremely important in determining the behavior of politicians and political consultants and staff.
And again, you know, what does every other politician have? They have pulsers. That's what a consultant, a political consultant, does. And for a third district in Arkansas, for Neil, that would not require a lot of resources to pull that area. And it would be an extremely compelling pitch to make to our people. Go ahead, Neil. My apologies.
Yeah, Neil, let me ask you, how big is your district, and what kind of on the ground campaigning have you done, and how well do you think you know the mind of your constituency?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm a little further to the right than probably the mean, but basically I'm where the Trump base is. That, you know, they, whenever I have events, I really do get an incredibly warm reception. People like me, they like my message, and they understand. I mean, people are smarter than you think they are. So this is a great district to do this experiment in that I'm doing with my campaign, because this is, you know, this is like a R plus 40 district. That it's not competitive for Democrats, and the person that I'm opposing is uniquely vulnerable. You know, he voted to certify the fraudulent 2020 coup. He voted for Nancy Pelosi's sham January 6th witch hunt committee. He's voted for red flag gun laws, and you know, he's had 12 years in Congress with nothing to show for it. He's taken Pfizer money and then just days later started promoting the vaccines. He voted for this vaccine database. He just wrote a letter to the U.S. Trade Representative asking for them to eliminate the Trump tariffs on China. So he's lobbying for China against the American worker. So, I mean, this guy really has no base of popular support. His advantage is purely money. He's got almost 2
top
million.
Down.
And exactly. It's Walmart, it's Pfizer, it's defense contractors. It's you name any evil corporate special interest, and they're funding him. Right now, he's trying to push for this World War III with Russia. He doesn't care where it is, Russia, China, Iran. He just wants more Southern boys dying on the battlefield for no reason. So, I mean, this guy's not well liked. So really my only limitation is money. It's how well am I able to get my name out there? How able, you know, I'm being suppressed by the media. I'll just give one brief example. I spoke at a rally for medical freedom in Little Rock at our state capital a few months ago, and There was a podium with a microphone bank and local TV crews, and there were some state legislators who spoke. And the moment that I got on stage, these news crews packed up their cameras, took their microphones away, and left. So there's a real media censorship here. So what I'm doing to win is just as much face-to-face direct contact with voters as I can. So I rely on supporters to set up meet and greets in their living rooms and restaurants and things like that. And then hopefully as I get closer to the election, I can start doing larger rallies. But I'm optimistic. I'm definitely, it's a viable campaign and I'm up against the right guy. So it's just a matter of how well I'm able to directly communicate.
That's great. So folks, if you are out there and you've got a pen or pencil handy, jot down the date April 2nd. April 2nd. If you want to meet Neil Kumar, on April 2nd, he's going to be speaking at an event in Charleston, South Carolina, that is being sponsored by Countercurrents. We are putting this event together as we speak. Neil is going to be there. There will be other speakers as well, people who are known to you. We'll trickle that data out just to keep you all on the edge of your seats, add people to the speakers list. But you've heard it here first. It's basically it's an event about nationalism, white identity politics on the ballot, and Neil will be speaking. There will be other speakers. It is the 2nd of April, and it will be in Charleston, South Carolina. And if you would like information on it, if you'd like to be vetted for attendance and actually go, write to cyan@countercurrents.com. That's C-Y-A-N, cyan@counter-currents.com. And she will add your name to the list. So I think that'll be a great opportunity for you to meet some other people, people in this audience. And Neil, can you also tell us about your website, the web address, and how people in the U.S., I assume people outside your district and state can help support your campaign as well. How can people support your campaign?
Especially
with donations.
So the biggest things, I mean, if you live in the district, hosting a meet and greet is great. But if you don't live in the district, anyone in America can donate. And, you know, there's no amount too small. I mean, $5 is great. So there's no one else talking like me. There's no one else that is directly confronting these issues. So if you believe in white identity politics, if you believe in restoring the historic American nation, then please do consider making a small contribution at neilforarkansas.com. And then I'm on social media, primarily on Gab. And my Gab is the same, Neil for Arkansas. So neilforarkansas.com and Neil for Arkansas.
And why stop with small donations when you can send big ones? So folks, if there are listeners out there who can make larger donations and would like to mess with the system a little bit, well, this man is an agent of chaos. And we would like to make sure that he has the best platform and the maximum amount of reach that that money can buy. So help him out with your support, big and small. Speaking of support, I want to thank a few people over at DLive for helping out. Variag has donated one ice cream and 14 lemons. Slog has donated 14 lemons. Hamburger Today, one Ninjagini. Thank you very much. He has a question. How does Neil feel the campaign is going? How can those outside his district help? So Neil, can you say a bit about how it's going? And again, repeat how people outside the district can help.
Yeah, the campaign is going well. The only difficulty that I have is just name ID. And so how to overcome that in the face of such censorship and in the face of the corporate machine. Walmart, I neglected to mention, is headquartered here in Bentonville. So they control pretty much all of the politics and media in our state. So I'm up against a real machine. So the only way to overcome that with the monetary disadvantage is just to face-to-face talk to as many people as possible. Now, when I do events, I do a great job. The difficulty is having the events in the first place, right? So I was just able to expose this Israeli operative, Greg Payne. So his smear campaign was a failure. But in the beginning, he was doing some real damage with the grassroots activists. But I've overcome that now. So I'm up. It's a David and Goliath battle, but this is a race that can be won. So on the whole, the campaign is going very well. And if you don't live in the state, the biggest thing you can do, aside from prayer and donating, is to spread the word. Tell people who share our cause about me. Send them to my website, and just, you know, keep the conversation going online. Just name recognition is really what I need.
Greg, I've got a question for Neil, real quick. Both of my parents are pretty bona fide political actors where I'm from. So I grew up in that environment, okay? And I've spent time around grassroots, rank and file type Republican leaders, like county chairs, you know, and just the sort of the Republican, what Sam Francis called the middle American radical. So my question is, you know, how is your access to the usual means of running your campaign as far as getting in front of these people, you know, speaking at events, et cetera? Because I can guarantee you, Neil, and you have already expressed this and you know this, that those type of rank and file people, if you can get in front of them and you sort of extend an olive branch to them, they'll listen to what you have to say. And before he answers the question, watch Neil's speech that he pinned on his Gap, because he got a thunderous reaction from an audience that started out very quiet. And the rank and file lady that handed you the microphone, she was very impressed. She was visibly impressed. So that's my question, Neil. And I'm very curious to hear your response.
Well, that's one of the reasons why that speech is one of the reasons why the party acted to disavow me so early on, because they saw that I'm capable of handling a large crowd. They saw that I really am a threat. You know, I'm not some crazy guy in the basement. I'm a real candidate. So that scared them. And so, you know, in the very beginning of my campaign, I was able to speak at a few GOP county committees, and I got an incredible reception each place I went. I've now been blacklisted from any GOP events. So my access to Republican Party affiliated events is nil. But the good news about that is the party really, really kneecapped itself and lost what little credibility that it had when it did nothing to stop the theft of the 2020 election. So most of the rank and file voters are completely done with the party. They're over it, and they're ready to burn the whole thing down. And so that's what I am. Like Greg said, I'm an agent of chaos. And so, you know, if you want to give them a middle finger, then I'm the guy to do it. So that's how I sell myself to the rank and file Trump supporter, and so that's why they like me.
Great. And how is your access to those opportunities, Neil? Well, the opportunities of rallies, et cetera, sitting down with these county people, volunteers. How are you doing on those things?
It is like the analogy would be like an avalanche, you know. So you do one meet and greet, and let's say there's like 15 people there, and then from that meet and greet, let's say four people decide to do another meet and greet for you with their friends and their family, and so it just snowballs out from there. So I'm doing well on that, but like I said, right, with party affiliated stuff and rallies, I'm not able to do that right now. I was, but now I'm not. I'll be doing my own rallies as I get closer to the election and build more name recognition. But okay, Right now, the main forum is these little meet and greets with anywhere between like 5 and 100 people. It's total luck of the draw. It really depends. But so a lot of my district is rural, And so you make friends with influencers in their communities. And so those are people whose opinions carry weight because everyone in the community knows them and they respect them. And so when they're on your side, then people take you seriously. And so that's one thing that I work on in more the farming areas.
Yeah. And this won't be the last time you run, Neil. So you're building up capital doing that. That's,
right.
That's great. I'm very pleased to hear that.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope you win the first time. That would be awesome. But if you don't, you still have built up political capital that you can use. You can use it for the next 2 years, building for another try at it. So I think this is a great position to be in. Honestly, you can't lose in a way. You know, it's just a question of, are you going to win now or down the line? And whatever political experience and capital you gain can be put to good use eventually. So I think this is wonderful. Back over at DLive, Slog has donated one ice cream. Thank you. Board Troll has donated one lemon and Varyag has donated 14 lemons. Folks, if you'd like to help out over at DLive, just chip in. All those diamonds, lemons, etc., they do add up. They helped us out a lot last year with our fundraiser. Now I'm going to go over to Entropy. If you'd like to go to Entropy, it's entropystream.live/countercurrents without the hyphen. You can see it right across the bottom of the screen. Go there. You can leave a donation along with a question or a comment, and we will get to them starting now. So Archie writes in with $5. Thank you. Jews are teaching the Holocaust in China to gain support and also teach Chinese youth that ethno-nationalism and national pride are bad. In China, I've seen pro-Afro-Chinese propaganda from Chinese youth. The CCP has it removed. China-born Afros exist. Yeah, I guess it's everywhere. Neil, do you have any thoughts on this kind of propaganda for diversity and against nationalism, even in China?
Yeah, that's fascinating, actually, about that going on in China. I wasn't aware of that, but so I won't really comment on China. Well, I'll say this: there's a reason why Russia, China, and Iran are uniquely targeted by this global homo system. It's because they're clearly trying to build some kind of iteration of a one world government, new world order sort of system, and you're seeing basically everything they wanted to do with denationalization, with climate change, they're doing with COVID, and so these are Russia, China, Iran. These are stubbornly nationalist countries that are, you know, not on board with the program. And you saw something. India, Narendra Modi is a Hindu nationalist, and he wasn't on board with the COVID agenda early on. And so there is this big propaganda effort to make it seem as if there was some kind of out of control COVID epidemic in India when there really wasn't. You know, you saw news reports of bodies piled up on the streets and everything. And it's just atrocity propaganda, but it really hurt him. And so he got back in line, and he's along with the global homo agenda now. So I think that's one reason why you see this kind of propaganda in ultra-nationalist societies. As far as in our country, I mean, look, so one of the things that Republicans often miss, yes, critical race theory is anti-white genocidal hate, and it's really a disgusting form of it. But American education, particularly in the teaching of American history, has been anti-white for decades. I mean, since the end of World War II. And I mean, we know World War II became the foundational myth of the West. And so one of my friends made a joke in high school in Arkansas about how the only two events that ever happened as far as American history teachers are concerned is slavery and the Holocaust, right? These are events that, you know, really have no relevance to anyone today, and yet we are continually beat over the head with it. Why? Well, very obviously, to teach young whites that whites are uniquely evil, right? That's the only purpose of beating us over the head with this kind of propaganda.
Yeah, and to teach people that they're evil and they have no right to happiness, it's basically just a form of abuse and softening up, followed by parasitism and more abuse if people start getting out of line. We would recognize this in relationships as pathological. You know, the person screaming, "You are horrible. You have no right to exist on your own." Well, we know that that's just a crazy person trying to basically get their hooks in you and deny you the right to your own happiness, especially without them. So it's abuse. It's massive psychological abuse and torture directed at whites. And it's in the schools. It's in all the forms of media and so forth. And it's something that I would like to see come to an end. And any pushback against this and pushing back against critical race theory is the beginning. That has a great deal of popular support behind it now. Any pushback is an extremely exciting prospect. I want to go back over to entropy. Gadius Maximus, thank you for your work in the chat. He's one of our most faithful supporters. Gadius sends $20. Thank you. He says, "Neil, how do you plan to punish banks and payment processors for picking and choosing who they will do business with based on political ideology?" That's the spirit. How do you plan to punish these people someday?
Yeah, it's not just banks. It's every business that has betrayed our nation by outsourcing, by offshoring American labor and production. They're all enemies. And so that's, you know, I'm unique in the GOP in that there's still this mentality that it is the duty of Republicans to defend big business, that it's somehow anti quote unquote free market to do anything against private corporations. And so you're seeing this with the vaccination mandates as well. The federal government is using private business to do what it wants to do, and it's going right along with it. So, you know, I'm not a friend of big business because big business is not a friend to my country. And so I want to, like Gaddy said, I want to punish these entities. So what are the tools that we have? We can strip corporate charters and end their company altogether. We can levy massive penalties. Big pharma as well. Big pharma has to be punished. Some industries, I'm not opposed to nationalization. I mean, the state has immense power against these corporations, and it chooses not to wield it.
That's very well said. I love the nationalization word. There used to be a time when private businesses feared the government. They don't fear the government anymore. They bought the government. They own the government. They used to fear regulatory agencies. Now they just buy regulatory agencies, buy politicians, and dictate what the regulations that they will accept. And it's not leading to a happy world. It's leading to a world where big pharma can, you know, poison hundreds of thousands of people with virtual impunity. That is a bad situation. I think capitalism and private property are good things, but you need the state to prevent abuse. Frankly, I think that the golden age of capitalism in America was during the Cold War, when the business community was so afraid of communism. The Red Scare was real. They were afraid of communism. They were competing with communism, and they had to be relatively patriotic. Willis Cardo, who died a few years ago now, talked to me one time, and he said, "Greg, in the 1950s, one of the most patriotic institutions in America was the Chamber of Commerce, believe it or not. But when communism fell and it became a unipolar world, that is when the fear of the red bullet in the back of the head disappeared for big business. And that is when they started going wild with globalization, wild with with race replacement, population shifts and things like that. Anything basically to drive down wages. They ceased being afraid. And they need to be afraid. They need to be afraid of righteous government action, not just lawless government action like communism, but righteous government action to rein in their worst impulses. Hey, I think that all people need to live under laws. Everybody has a dark side. Everybody is willing to abuse freedom if they're given too much of it and if there's no protection. And so that's true of big business as well. And it's nice to have somebody talking about that. I don't think anybody in the Congress today really talks about scaring these bastards into doing the right thing. They're just not afraid.
Into doing what their voters want.
And yeah.
That is
yeah.
Go ahead, Neil.
Yeah, I mean, look at so the totally unprecedented response to this so-called COVID pandemic, these lockdowns. What did that do? Right, churches were closed, but abortion clinics and liquor stores were open. People are watching more porn than ever, taking more drugs than ever. And what happened? The mom and pop businesses, the American middle class was totally eviscerated, leaving only the businesses that were allowed open. And what were they? Walmart and Amazon, right? So America has not really had a free market in many, many years. The government picks winners and losers. What people don't grasp is that companies like Walmart, they're not capitalist entities. They want to be state monopolies. They want to be the state grocery store. Like that's their goal. And that's what they've come closer to now than ever before, because people just aren't allowed by the state to compete. So how do you call this a free market? How do you call this a capitalist country?
Right. It's not. Yeah, we are being de-kulakized, basically. The middle class business owners are being destroyed. Now, in the 1970s, I'm old enough to remember the 1970s. I was alive then, folks. Jimmy Carter deregulated the oil industry and slapped a windfall profit tax on the huge new profits that they reap from that. Would you support, Neil, something like a windfall profits tax on Walmart and Amazon and all of these primarily these giant corporations that reaped windfall profits during the COVID pandemic?
Yeah, I would absolutely. And I also think that is the duty of if it was a federal mandate, then the federal should be responsible. If it were a state mandate, then the state should be responsible. But for anyone who lost their livelihood as a result of these lockdowns, they should be repaid the entirety of their lost income based on the prior year's numbers, right? I mean,
right.
It's criminal what was done to these innocent people just trying to make a living, right? They're making it impossible to live in this country. And so I want to make it impossible for these businesses to operate in this country while they're operating as parasites on the population. So like I mentioned, these so-called American companies that have no loyalty to this country but are only able to exist because they're here, that outsource and offshore American labor. This is fueling the opioid crisis, the general despair and hopelessness in the heartland. I want to tax them so heavily that they literally cannot operate. I want to make their lives impossible until they relocate everything back to this country where it belongs.
Years and years ago, I remember Rush Limbaugh. This is in the 90s. Clinton was in the White House. And the day after Clinton got elected, I tuned into Rush Limbaugh. I'd heard about him, but I'd never listened to him before that. And I needed some solace. So anyway, I listened to Rush Limbaugh a lot during the Clinton years. And I remember yelling at the radio one time, a tariff is a tax, Rush. It's a tax. He was repeating this stupid Chamber of Commerce free market talking points about, oh, tariffs are bad for consumers. A tariff is a tax, and every tax has economic consequences. And the only question is which kind of tax has the best economic consequences? America became an industrial powerhouse because it had tariffs. The federal government was primarily funded by tariffs on imported manufactured goods for more than a century. I forget how long it was exactly, but a very long time. And that was a good system for funding the federal government, tariffs on foreign imported goods. If we slapped tariffs on foreign imported goods, factories would come back to the United States. We would make it worth their while. We would see the same results of these pro-industrialization policies that we had before by simply returning to funding the federal government with tariffs. And I do think that if we do fund the federal government with tariffs, and if we do put windfall profits taxes on Jeff Bezos and Walmart and so forth, that the money from that should go towards recapitalizing small business, encouraging entrepreneurship, small businesses, individual businesses, and so forth. That's really the future. We want a broad, strong middle class, not a bunch of peasants, basically, who are all queuing up to buy things at Walmart and living in rented shanties and things like that.
Absolutely.
Let's look at entropy again and see if we got some more questions here. Okay, Stonewall Brigade sends $5. Good luck, Neil, pulling for you. Jasper writes in with $50. Mr. Kumar, you must have come under tremendous political and social pressure since announcing your candidacy. If we are going to normalize and advance white identity politics, we will need more intrepid pioneers like yourself. Based on your experience, what advice would you give white advocates who are considering running for public office? This is a very good question.
Great question. Jasper's the man. Go ahead, Neil.
Well, I mean, first of all, just have a thick skin. Understand that these names, they don't. So when everyone is a racist, then no one is a racist, right? So these words do have staying power. These smears do have staying power, but their power is diminishing, and so. Really, the key to doing dissident politics is to not ever back down, never cuck, never apologize, never soften anything, never backpedal. Own what you say and continue to say it. And as you know, the social pressure is real. My name is dragged through the mud by the party, by the system, the ADL. But you view it as endorsements, as badges of honor. Don't get bogged down in any kind of negativity. Just keep pushing forward. So really it's attitude. It's your personal attitude, I think, is what makes or breaks you. So if you don't have thick skin, then it's, and if you're not ready to be demonized, then don't do it.
Yes. And I think another important source of value Neil represents is that he will serve as wise counsel to people who run these types of campaigns in the future, because he's really at the tip of the spear. He is a pioneer in this area. And that's another good reason to support Neil.
Yeah, that's well said. Absolutely. Let's look at entropy again. Carl Gross sends in $20. Please ask Neil to remind listeners that they may contribute up to $50 cash anonymously. And I'm going to put a couple of links in the chat he sends. So go ahead.
Actually, with the FEC, you can donate up to $200 anonymously. Anything over $200 has to be reported.
Even better. So yeah, $200 anonymously.
Right.
That's very good news.
And then the maximum is $2,900 for individuals and $5,800 for married couples. But so your information is safe though if you're under 200.
That's great.
Yes, and there's no precedent of anyone getting in trouble for this. So, you know, be brave, you know, stand up. That's very important. We need to sort of diffuse concerns people have about donating, and we need to do that in a more deliberate manner, I think, than we have as a movement up to this point.
Oh, yeah.
There are plenty of ways to support us anonymously, you know, without risk. So if you want to talk to me about that, please send me an email at robert@counter-currents.com.
You mentioned donors. So my opponent, his name is Steve Womack. I call him Deep State Steve. He has been calling my larger donors that are local and personally and telling them that I'm a racist, I'm an extremist, blah, blah, blah. And the response, my donors, when they get these calls, they tell me about it immediately. And they tell me what they say. They say, well, first of all, no, he's not. And second of all, I don't care. I'm supporting him anyway. And so these anti-white, like old guard GOP people, they can't wrap their minds around that, around someone being called a racist and not caring. Because in their world, in the boomer worldview, that's the worst thing you can be. They'd rather be called a pedophile than a racist. And I mean that. Like, that's the worst thing in their minds. So when they lob these attacks at me and it just slides right off, they don't know what to do with me.
Right. And there's a way to get around that with the boomers as well, Neil. You just say, we're not against anybody. We're just pro-white. Correct. So nobody's going to get in the way of that. And I've had these conversations many times with these types of people. We need to tap into their support. I think the boomers are going to leave tens of trillions of dollars behind over the next few decades. So people can say what they want about the boomers, but I simply do not agree with that. I've had very positive experience with boomers, and they're absolutely winnable as far as our cause is concerned if you approach them in the correct way.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things that some of the party operatives have cast aspersions on me for is my total immigration moratorium. Well, as we all know, America has a long history of immigration restrictionism, and so the way that I explain it to people, and they get it every time, you know, why do you lock your doors at night? Is it because you hate the world? You hate everyone outside? No, it's because you love the people inside, right? It's being pro-white, being pro your country does not have to be anti anything else. It's love. It's not hate. White identitarianism is motivated by the purest of love.
Yes. And of course, we need to oppose our enemies. But at the end of the day, yes, we have a positive message. Sorry.
Yeah, that was one of the things that was most interesting about the Giardina book. The significant percentage of people who have positive white identity that don't really have negative attitudes towards outgroups. You would think that they would be joined together. But psychologically, that's just not the case. Psychologically, it's quite easy and possible for people to have a positive view of one's in-group and want to do well by it, think well of your in-group, and not have a particularly negative view of other people. It's just a psychological reality that that's the case. And this is why the left is extremely self-defeating by just going hard on the racist accusation, because it actually makes people angry, because it's not true. It's not true of a lot of people, and they're incensed about this. They think racism is a bad thing, You know, it means hating people for no reason whatsoever, right? They think it's a bad thing, and that's not what's motivating them. And they get angry after a while when people keep accusing them of that. And I think that this is one of the reasons why the racism charge is breaking down. People just, you know, they, at a certain point, they're going to say, yeah, well, I don't care what you call me. I'm taking my own side. But before they get to that point, they're fuming. They're angry because they think it's unjust. It's unjust for these people to constantly go for the racism charge over and over again and to try and make that into a absolute political and social death sentence. That is a problematic thing, and it makes people angry. It makes them afraid. And it's creating a huge backlash, which is wonderful. But we just don't want the Republicans to benefit from it.
Yes. And winning is the most important thing, of course, but we are nationalists. And so we should, I think respect is a good word, respect other people insofar as it doesn't conflict with victory and winning. But Greg, you've been very consistent on this. You've expressed this very well. And I do think that consistency is important. And again, you know, the goal is to activate these middle American radicals. And so we want to make sure, mm-hmm. insofar as we're not compromising on our principles, we want to make sure that we're sort of meeting them where they're at.
Yeah. So Max Moon has donated one Ninjagini. Great show. Good luck, Neil. And Hamburger Today has donated another Ninjagini. Great show. Great panel. Well, thank you both. We really appreciate it. I'm going to check again over at Entropy and see if there are some more donations coming in. And folks, you can ask us questions about other stuff too, what's going on in the news as well. And we will definitely give you great answers. So Gadius writes in with another $3. Neil, what are the biggest media outlets in your district that have comments enabled? That's a good question.
I don't think any of them have comments enabled. There's a state paper. It's the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. It's funny when someone announces that they're running for like dog catcher, they get their name in the paper like prominently with the big article. But they've put my name in two online articles. Once just when I launched my campaign, and they picked the most controversial parts of my platform to kind of make me seem like a lunatic, but it was fine. And then they did a very brief article about how the party had disavowed me. But aside from that, the local news people get their information from is television. So that's KNWA and Fox 24, and they're leftist shit libs is who runs them. So they haven't said my name once. I suspect they probably wouldn't say my name even on election night unless I win. Then they would say that I won. It'd be the first time that they'd ever said anything about me. So, yeah, there's a dearth of local news really nationwide because there's been a lot of centralization of mass media. So that these independent papers and everything, they don't really exist anymore.
That's very interesting. Let's talk about some nitty-gritty proposals in your platform. So the first thing in your platform is stop the Great Replacement. You want a 20-year moratorium on all immigration. I think that's fantastic. Although you do say that you'll accept South African refugees dispossessed of their land. That's a noble thing. Build the wall, deny public services to illegal aliens, deport every single illegal, and end birthright citizenship. All of that's extremely based and strong. You also put a big emphasis on the Second Amendment, defending the Second Amendment. Do you want to talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically, I don't really believe in any restriction on our right to self-defense. When you see leftists that are calling for gun confiscation, or even things like they're targeting the primer manufacturers and things like that, because they want to make guns, you know, useless paperweights. They're not motivated by any sense of safety or anything that that they say they clearly just want to disarm whites. And so, you know, well, I'll say this too. This past year has brought us some extremely dark and disturbing legal trends, you know, making clear that the justice system is geared entirely towards stripping whites of their civil rights. You look at Sines v. Kessler, there's some debate over how much of the damages will actually be collected, but that's not the point. The principle established by this case is that the First Amendment right to assembly has effectively been ended for whites, right? Because if white dissidents, and that's the only people this will be levied against, if white patriots hold any kind of protest and there's any disturbance whatsoever caused by any party, then the organizers are going to be held responsible. It's a very chilling effect. You look at the lynching of Derek Chauvin. You look at the wave of recent black criminals who were getting off scot-free from murdering whites. Billy Chimiermier, a Kenyan immigrant and perhaps the most prolific serial killer of all time, whose victims were mostly elderly white women, got a mistrial. Some jurisdictions are moving towards criminalizing calling the police on blacks altogether. So clearly whites are just supposed to allow blacks and anyone else to rob, rape, and butcher them with impunity. And the greatest travesty of all is the McMichaels and the Ahmaud Arbery case, life in prison, effectively a death sentence for the crime of defending themselves and their communities from a known thug. So the Second Amendment is really more important now than ever. I'm shocked that Kyle Rittenhouse got off of his trial. I was expecting him to be lynched in the same way that Chauvin was. And it's interesting in that case, really, it was such a clear-cut case of self-defense that I guess that's what made, and he was a teenage boy. So I think, you know, that's what made GOP influencers and politicians and pundits feel like they could defend him. But you saw things just as ridiculous in the trial of James Fields from Charlottesville, and yet no one said a word in his defense. And so he was railroaded. Nobody said anything about Derek Chauvin, really. I mean, there was no institutional support behind him. And there was even less support for the McMichaels. I mean, you saw people in one breath celebrating the Rittenhouse not guilty verdict and also celebrating the McMichael verdict, even though both parties did nothing wrong. So, I mean, well, this all goes back to the Second Amendment.
Yeah, I think it was very fortunate for Kyle Rittenhouse that he didn't actually shoot any black people. I think that if his victims had been black people, he wouldn't have gotten a fair trial, even though they would have been trying to kill him just as dead as these you know Jewish and white pedophile rapist Antifa types who went after him. They were nasty people, but they weren't sufficiently dark. And therefore, I think he actually got a fair trial in virtue of that. But if he had shot even one black person, even if the guy was clearly trying to kill him, I don't think the jury would have been able to stand up to all the hectoring and brainwashing and intimidation. There's certainly open intimidation from the president to low IQ Maxine Waters, all the way down to local politicians in the Derek Chauvin trial. It should have been a mistrial just on the grounds that the president of the United States is talking about the proper verdict before the jury has had a chance to actually deliberate. This is absolutely scandalous.
Yes, it is. It's very disturbing. I've lost a lot of my faith, maybe not all of it, but you know, 90% of it in the legal system. I think that the best advice to give people is just try to steer clear of it, because you're not going to be treated fairly if you're white.
Yeah, absolutely. Back at DLive, one lemon donator has donated one lemon. Okay, I'd like to hear from one Ninjet donator before the stream is out. Let's pop over to Odyssey and see if there's some questions over there. I keep forgetting to check in Odyssey. I apologize to our people over at Odyssey. So let's just see if there are a few people asking questions. What's Neil's position on foreign affairs, for instance, Ukraine? What are your thoughts about the attempt to whip up a war about Ukraine right now?
Yeah, so very adamantly. Well, I'll start by saying this, you know, you can understand my foreign policy by understanding that, you know, my greatest American hero is Charles Lindbergh and the America First Committee. I firmly agree with that position, which is no foreign wars whatsoever unless they are in direct defense of the homeland. Now, what is the last war that America as a country fought as a response to a direct threat to the homeland? The War of 1812. When was the last time Southerners fought for defense of the homeland? The War for Southern Independence. So pretty much every war since then, I do support the Mexican War because President Polk was awesome and completed our manifest destiny. But that aside, amen. We do not need to be spending one American penny or spilling one drop of American blood in any more pointless foreign wars. These are fought for foreign interest and bankers that have nothing to do with American. They look at the Bush presidency is really one of the worst in history. Look what the war on terror did, right? It's just awful. These neocons belong in a dark cell somewhere where they can't hurt any more American boys. I mean, these are really, it's criminal what they're doing. They're literally trying to start World War III right now. We have no interest whatsoever in the Ukraine.
I wonder if there's some space in Guantanamo for the neocons to keep them from harming, other people.
Yeah. Yeah. Perhaps. And they belong on the front lines as well, along with their entire family.
Yeah, and we go back to Victoria Nuland, the timeless words, the timeless wisdom as far as our perspective of Victoria Nuland. You know, fuck the UN. You know, we're going to put this thing into Ukraine. And where is she coming from, folks? I don't think I need to elaborate on that.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about your platform. I want to skip forward to you have a nice section here on ending the war on the working class. Basically industrial policy, things like that. We've already touched on some of these things. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I'll start with the top line on the ending the war on the working class, which is restoring our freedom of association by repealing the 1964 Civil Rights Act, along with the entire edifice of, you know, civil rights, discrimination, hate, and affirmative action legislation. The civil rights movement, you know, was never about equalizing anything. It was never about abolishing any kind of racial hierarchy. It was about setting up a new hierarchy with whites at the bottom. So people, conservatives, so-called conservatives, like to talk about MLK and how critical race theory and all of this is some kind of bastardization of MLK's colorblind dream. Well, no, this is his dream. White genocide was his dream. Like, everything happening now is the direct and logical, inevitable consequence of this civil rights regime. And so if you want to start to make headway against it in a legalistic society, then you have to strip away the legal foundations of it. And that's what this edifice is. And then on economic policy, on industrial economics, I already mentioned rebuilding the American manufacturing base, really by just imposing tariffs on foreign goods, but more than anything on really brutally punishing the so-called American companies that put us here. And then something that really sets me apart from any other candidate running for any office is I have a third position as economic policy. My economics is really motivated by restoring the American family and raising our birth rates. So what I want to do is provide progressive childbirth bounties, similar to the Hungarian model, and also something like universal basic income to whole families where the mother stays home to raise her children. So I want to encourage childbirth, but I also want to encourage stay-at-home motherhood and restoring the traditional family. By ending the Great Replacement, you take care of a large portion of the wage depression, because what we need to get back to is the single working wage model, where one, you know, factory worker can support an entire family comfortably. I want to end no-fault divorce and overhaul the anti-family, anti-father family court system. And then I really want to punish universities, because the university system is a large reason of why we are where we are. Because what's the number one reason why people say they don't want to start families? Well, it's not because they don't want to, it's because they don't think they can afford to, and it's largely because of student loan debt. So I am calling for student loan debt forgiveness, but not in the way that the Democrats do, because they want to let the universities off scot-free. I'm the opposite. I want to forgive student debt from the students, but make the universities entirely liable for the cost. And if they don't want to pay, then we're going to tax their endowments and you know, things like that. So the universities have to be punished.
That's a beautiful thought. Yes, I mean, they are absolutely absolute citadels of corruption and degeneracy and just bad ideas. That's where a lot of these ideas that are destroying America have fermented for decades, and that's where they'll retreat to if they're rebuffed in the political system. And we need to go to the source. We need to go to the nest and clean the nest out, frankly, because that's how we win. Again, the whole Republican thing is never to deal with the fundamental consequences or fundamental causes, never to punish your enemies. It's just sheer weakness on so many levels. They get miraculously put back in office one more time, and then they don't actually try and win the culture war. A lot of them are just unintellectual, anti-intellectual. You seem like a really bright guy, Neil, though, and you went to the University of Chicago. That's a very impressive achievement. Can you tell us more about your time there, what you studied, your intellectual life, things like that? I think that's an important part of the full picture here.
Yeah, I actually I studied anthropology. I knew that I wasn't really going to do anything with anthropology career-wise, but it was very interesting. And, you know, Kevin McDonald in Culture of Critique has talked a lot about the development of the field of anthropology. And it's fascinating, because it used to be something entirely different, you know, before it was taken over by the Boas and the Meads of the world. So it was, I mean, it was a very hardcore leftist doctrine as I studied it. And so, you know, you read it and just the core curriculum there, you're reading fundamental anti-white, anti-nationalist thinkers like, you know, pedophile Foucault and all these other, you know, pseudo philosophers that will want to deconstruct reality. So it was a sort of oppressive experience, reading all these thinkers, but it's very valuable, and I wouldn't trade it for anything, because, you know, I more so than I think any other candidate, you know, I really do firmly and fundamentally understand the leftist worldview. I understand what motivates them, because that's the intellectual life that I was steeped in at Chicago. And so, you know, understanding where they're coming from allows me to counter them more. But yeah, Chicago was a good experience, but I wouldn't wish it on anyone either.
I would say about the, first of all, Newland said the EU. So I just have to correct myself on that. The EU, screw the EU. But on the University of Chicago, Neil, and getting back to something that you said about the Civil Rights Act, really replacing the Constitution, Christopher Caldwell wrote a great book about that called The Age of Entitlement. Another interesting thing about the Age of Entitlement is at the end, he says, if this continues, you know, I'm talking about our system and everything, the way everything is going now, you're going to have white nationalism. It's inevitable. And that's what he said at the end. And as far as University of Chicago, Mearsheimer, you know, is not on our side domestically, but he's a shrewd, very shrewd commentator on international relations and foreign policy. And he has a great track record of successful, correct predictions. And he says in a book called The Great Delusion about international liberalism and how it's unpalatable and it's unsupported, he says that America is a fiercely nationalistic country. And he has been saying this for years. And then, of course, it came out of the closet with the Trump campaign. So the people who are blackpilled about white identity politics, you've lost the argument. I'm sorry. It's not personal. It's not personal. I'm never personal against anybody. But we have seen this with the Trump campaign. And now we've seen it in the concrete data of these polls. So I wondered if you had any thoughts about the Age of Entitlement, Neil, and also Mearsheimer, University of Chicago scholar.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, Mearsheimer was also one of the authors of The Israel Lobby, which was a path-breaking book about the influence of AIPAC and the entire Israeli edifice that really controls American politics. So yeah, there's certainly some courageous figures at Chicago, but it's as with the entire academic system, there's less and less mavericks as time goes on. But back to the Age of Entitlement, this was, you know, I was already opposed to the Civil Rights Act before this book, but the value of that book is that it really mainstreamed this idea. Now, he doesn't anywhere in the book come out and explicitly state that we need to repeal the Civil Rights Act, but that's the only logical conclusion from reading the book, that that's what he believes. Yes. And what's really incredible is that Tucker Carlson, it was very brief, it's like a 1-minute segment. Tucker introduced the book. He didn't have Caldwell on, but he called it his favorite book of the year. Now, that is a stirring endorsement. So when people, you know, that's actually the number one thing on my platform that people are like, what the hell is he talking about? He wants to bring back slavery. He wants to bring back segregation. That's what people think because they don't know what the Civil Rights Act really is. So I always start by explaining that this is not a fringe position. This has been endorsed. I mean, the Wall Street Journal gave this book an incredible review. Tucker Carlson endorses it. That's not a fringe position. And the Civil Rights Act itself, you know, it's not legitimate. It shouldn't have been allowed to pass because its only legal basis is a, you know, made up bastardization of the Commerce Clause, which allows the Congress to make laws regulating interstate commerce, right? But over the years, particularly accelerating with the New Deal jurisprudence, you had the definition of commerce expanded in a circular logic of absolute power, where commerce means anything that might have the slightest indirect effect on commerce. And so the Civil Rights Act was their answer to, you know, well, the 14th Amendment itself is not legitimate for a variety of reasons that would take another hour to explain, so I won't really go into it. But the Civil Rights Act was the government's answer to, you know, how to do the 14th Amendment, but to private action, to private businesses. So it's not legitimate. So on that basis alone, it should be repealed if we truly are a constitutional republic. But what the Civil Rights Act did, like I said, it created a new hierarchy, a second constitution, because when you make sweeping statements about hate, discrimination, whatever, civil rights, you also have to necessarily create this totalitarian enforcement mechanism to ensure it, right? So that's what the Civil Rights Act really did. Yes. Once I explain that to people, they understand.
Yes, and he says, Neil, this is a very simple point that you can make. He says, if you can't allow who comes into your business or not, who owns your business? Do you own your business or does the government own your business? And there's nothing more anti-American than fundamentally violating privacy in that sense, or the First Amendment, Fourth and First Amendment, freedom of association first and privacy in the fourth. So that's a good, we need to at least alter, if not repeal, the Civil Rights Act. So this is a very important issue. And you can make powerful little statements about that will
be very appealing to people. It's not about tyranny, because the height of tyranny is forcing individuals and businesses to live and transact with those whom they do not want to, right? Freedom of association is how this country was run for its entire history. And yes. So, you know, forced integration, forced association it's on the level with forced segregation, right? It's tyrannical.
One thing I think is that's very important, it's an allied issue, but it's not exactly the same thing as a Civil Rights Act, is simply to challenge this assumption that's now embedded in laws that if racial groups perform differently, that is ipso facto evidence of prejudice, racial prejudice. If blacks are more often arrested, well, has nothing to do with the fact that they commit more crimes. It must be caused by racism. When blacks are overrepresented in highly lucrative jobs, nobody ever says, well, could this be racism? Could there be racism at the NFL and the NBA? So it only goes one way. But anytime a privileged group is underrepresented in jobs and positions that they want, or overrepresented in places they don't want to be, like prison, it's just asserted that this has to be the product of racism, and therefore it's immoral, it should be illegal, we need to rectify this with social programs. We need to basically just deny that's the case, and assert that there's an alternative hypothesis, namely that certain races are overrepresented in jail and underrepresented in boardrooms because of their intrinsic traits and preferences, and that inequality is not, therefore, prima facie evidence of some kind of racial discrimination that needs to be rectified.
Yeah, I mean, just the reality of race has to be acknowledged. It's just that simple.
Yeah, yeah. If there are different races, it just stands to reason that they're going to have different outcomes in the absence of any kind of invidious discrimination. But that's not allowed anymore. And it's just an oppressive, appalling dogma. We had a summer of riots and agitation about black criminals and these absurd charges that black men are just being mowed down randomly for no reason whatsoever. And we didn't have a president who had the guts or the information to stand up there and say, no, there's an alternative hypothesis here. It's not just racism. The reason why there are so many black men having unhappy encounters with the police is that they commit vastly disproportionate amounts of violent crime. We can't have a civilization. We can't preserve civilization unless we actually speak the truth about these sorts of things. And there are these dogmas that are being enforced that don't allow us to speak the truth, that don't allow us to assert the alternative hypothesis here.
Yes, Greg, you have 300 million people who actively want to migrate to the United States. And they're people with much different abilities than ourselves. And then you have, Hubert wrote a great article about this on Countercurrents, Sub-Saharan Africa. You have a billion people down there. All of them would like to move to Europe. And this is so obvious. You know, this is not sustainable. And the only way to prevent this, it's an apocalypse. It's a Camp of the Saints apocalypse, is to organize people of European descent into a powerful political force. That is the only way. That is the only way to prevent the complete collapse of Western civilization, collapse and disappearance.
Yeah,
nicely said.
Nicely said, yeah.
So we have a couple more donations I want to thank people for. One lemon donator has just donated 2 lemons, okay? And Hamburger Today has donated 1 Ninjet. This is such a good show. Here you go, Greg. He says, well, thank you very much. It's very generous. Hadrian was right, has also donated 3 ice cream. Very generous. We have, I don't think, any more questions at Entropy. I'm just hitting refresh. Nope. And I don't see anything new on Odyssey, but Odyssey's interface is kind of, I'm not comfortable with this platform. I might be overlooking something. I apologize if I do. We're running out of time. We've run out of time. This has been a really good conversation. Neil, I really enjoyed having you on the show. So can you say a few final words about how people can help out, how people can follow you, how people can root for your campaign?
Yeah. Again, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed this as well. I'm a big Countercurrents fan. So go to neilforarkansas.com, N-E-I-L for Arkansas.com, and that's how you can donate and see my platform. It's a very comprehensive platform. I try to touch every base that I can on the most important issues. And then you can follow me on Gab at Neil for Arkansas. And if you don't live here and if you can't contribute, then the biggest thing you can do is just to share my content, spread the word, and let people know about me.
That is great. I want to thank you for coming on the show. I want to thank Robert for co-hosting. I really appreciated it. It makes it a lot easier to have another person on the panel, definitely.
It's been an honor, gentlemen. It's been an honor. Thank you.
And I also want to thank our moderators out there. You've been great. I want to thank the donors. You've been very, very generous. The commentators, it's all wonderful. Our friends in the chat, Thomas Dubin, I see you in there. Thank you for being here. So we will be back a week from today with another episode of Countercurrents Radio, but you don't have to wait that long because tomorrow the writer's block is on starting at 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern time, 10 p.m. That would be 10 p.m. Central European time. That's where Nick Gilvey, our host, is actually located. He's our man in Macedonia. And Nick is going to be joined by James Omura. And the topic of tomorrow's stream is the best month yet, because every month at Countercurrents is the best month yet. And he's going to, he and James are going to be discussing the best articles for January at Countercurrents. So I think it should be a really entertaining conversation. So please tune in tomorrow at the Writer's Block, and we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.